Hi there, my name is Christina. I'm one half of the White Noise Show, but today I'm going solo. To kick off International Albinism Awareness Day on June the 13th, I've been chatting with interesting people with albinism. My first podcast is with Peter Rash. It's really engaging, but at the same time very emotional. Peter is founder of Under the Same Sun, which is a charity working with people with albinism internationally, but it predominantly focuses on Africa and more specifically Tanzania, where people with albinism are being killed for their body parts. As I said, it's emotional, it's gripping. Children under the age of 16, possibly it's not appropriate for, and those of a squeamish disposition. I talk about skin cancer. I talk about what Peter's seen in terms of the killings. I talk about what they do. And we also talk about Peter and his life and his work and his childhood with albinism. So it's really fascinating. It's interesting. I really want you to share this. The more you share it, the more people get to listen, the higher up the iTunes rating as it goes. So you can find me on Twitter, it's Christina Venning. Facebook, it's The White Noise Show. And you can find my blog, thebluffingtonpost.co.uk, where I'll post links about Peter's charity and his work, or thewhitenoiseshow.com, where I'll also post information about Under the Same Sun. So as I said, anybody of a squeamish disposition, maybe this one isn't for you, but everyone else, enjoy. Growing up, talk to me about your experience of albinism. Did you have any brothers or sisters with it? Were you the only one in your family? Were you kind of open and talked about it amongst your family? Or how was albinism for you when you were growing up?
Albinism for me growing up, there was kind of two sides to the issue or the story. One was the side inside my family, inside my home, and one was the story outside my home. There's three children in my family. Neither of my parents had albinism. I'm the third, I'm the youngest child. There's three boys in my family. My oldest brother, Paul, who's 8 years older than me, was born with albinism. My middle brother, David, who's 5 years older than me, was born without albinism. So my parents figured, okay, we're kind of done having kids with albinism now. We just have the one. And then they actually weren't planning to have any more children, period. My brothers were 3 years apart. But I was what they call this accident, I hope a happy one. So I came along unexpectedly, and then when I was born, I had albinism, which really surprised them because I think in their minds they thought there wouldn't be a separation by a child without albinism, you know, because the odds are 1 in 4 statistically. So now we've got 2 in 3 going on. But those are statistical odds, and they don't always pan out in reality. So for me, growing up in my family, because my mom and dad had been through this already with my brother, Paul, when he was born, it was not a shock at all about me. It was a huge shock when Paul was born. They had no idea, you know, at all that he was going to be, like, he was born and my dad had jet black hair.
Right.
He's of Irish-English descent. My mom had dark brown hair. They didn't know what albinism was. And my brother now is 57. So 57 years ago in Montreal, Canada, very few people knew anything about albinism. And in the hospital in which he was born, the nurses and doctors didn't know anything about it. And this child was born, and the nurse said, oh, you have a fair-haired child. My parents, of course, were quite puzzled because they both had dark hair and there was nobody blonde in the family. And that's all they knew. This kid had really white hair. They didn't know why. And that was it. He was discharged from the hospital, and they brought him home. And after a few months, my mom noticed that his vision didn't seem to be developing normally. He wasn't responding to visual stimuli the way other babies were. So she brought him to an ophthalmologist who said, you know, I can't really tell you what's wrong with this kid. Basically, that ophthalmologist didn't diagnose that he had albinism.
What?
No, it didn't say much about it. And then so she brought him to another ophthalmologist who said, yes, this child has albinism. He's going to be blind. Basically, the prognosis for his life is not very good. You better put him in a school for the blind. In those days, people who were legally blind were pretty much in residential schools, you know, like 60 years ago in Canada. Put him in a school for the blind. He'll make brooms in a broom shop. He won't have much prognosis in his life. That's as good as it gets. Have a nice day. And so my mom left that office and said, forget that. No kid of mine is going to be put away in a school making brooms. So she didn't accept that doctor's prognosis in terms of what Paul could achieve. So she brought him yet to a third doctor, who basically said, yes, he has albinism, yes, he has low vision, but with the right accommodations and support in school, he'll be able to manage. And so they went through lots of struggles around that, but they managed. Paul went to a school, an elementary school, that had a special class designated for visually impaired kids in those days. It was in a public school, but it was a dedicated class. And so he did well academically because they had that Sight Savers class, they called it. And then my brother David was born, and he was, you know, didn't have albinism. Then I was born, so they kind of had it all figured out by the time I was born in terms of what to do. And then I had this older brother that with a condition. So for me and my brother David, this was entirely normal. So for me, the problems inside my home were zero. Like, my big problem I had was the school system changed in Quebec at the time so that they got away from institutionalization, which was good, but they went into integration, but they didn't really do integration. Integration meant dump the kid in the public school and hope for the best.
Yeah, they didn't know how to accommodate you.
No, there was zero, you know, special ed assistance or training or, like, absolutely nothing. So it was kind of like dump the kid in the class and whatever, you know. So my challenge was the opposite. I had no support. So my mom was always in there advocating, explaining, you know, he has to sit close to the blackboard, he needs large print, you know, all that stuff, and advocating and making noise to make sure I got what I needed. So she was a strong advocate for me.
Did you advocate for yourself? Were you confident in sort of saying what you wanted?
Especially once I got a little older, like when I was really young, of course.
Sure.
Not really, but certainly as I, you know, got into the later grades of elementary school, you know, grade 4, 5, 6 in high school, yes, very much so. But I had some teachers that were really supportive and others that were really not that swift, frankly, that just didn't believe I had a visual impairment or didn't want to accommodate me for whatever series of reasons. So like all kids, I had some good teachers and some not so good teachers. And it was tough because I was the only kid in my school, big inner city school in Montreal, with a visual impairment. And you know, the teachers didn't know what to do. And then all the teasing and social isolation from kids. We moved around a lot as a family. We were fairly poor growing up. We lived in rough neighborhoods. So I was always not only the new kid on the block, but the new kid on the block who looked different. And so, you know, I was called names, Whitey, Casper the Ghost, Snow White. You know, I was beaten up by a gang of kids once before being the weird-looking albino and physically, like, violently beaten up. So I went through some tough spots through that piece, through the, you know, the teenage years especially.
How did you deal with that? How did that, did it sort of make you introverted and shy?
Actually, I would say by temperament, I was, on one hand, you could say shy in that I was not a social butterfly. I was not socially outgoing with strangers, but I was not fearful or withdrawn from other settings. Like, for example, from the time my earliest memory, I was very comfortable with public speaking. I could get up and speak in front of a crowd and have zero nervousness around it. So I don't know if that was just a function of my temperament and or it was my experience. But so on one hand, I didn't have a big group of friends. But on the other hand, I was very comfortable presenting myself in public. And my mom always taught me to not be ashamed of who I was and to stand up for myself. And, you know, if people had a negative comment, it was their issue. It wasn't my issue. And that was their ignorance, not mine. And to feel that God had made me the way I was for a reason. And I remember one day coming home in grade five or six from a school, and that the teacher had forced us all to play baseball during phys ed class. And I explained to the teacher, I can't play baseball. She said, well, what do you mean you can't play? I said, well, I can't see the baseball. By the time it gets close to me and I swing the bat, it'll hit me in the head. I just don't have enough vision to do this. No, you're being lazy. You're having a bad attitude. You'll try. I says, well, it's not a matter of a bad attitude. I just can't try. I can't physically do it. But she wouldn't take no for an answer. So I'm up there at bat, and the kids pick teams. And I was the last kid to be picked. And
obviously,
picked last, it's like, oh, we're stuck with Peter. Everyone knew I couldn't play. They knew what I knew, that I'd be a liability to the team. And so I'm standing up there, and as it happened, it was a bright, sunny day. The sun's coming right in my eyes. I'm standing at bat, waiting for this ball to come at me, knowing I'm not going to have a hope in the world of hitting this thing. And lo and behold, I didn't hit it. And what's worse, it hit my very expensive low-vision glasses and broke them, right? And my parents didn't have a lot of money. So I have the embarrassment of this whole scenario. I go home. My glasses are broken. I have a bruise on my face. And I'm just beside myself, grade 5 or 6 boy. And I go to my mom, and I'm quite upset and crying, and I just tell her, you know, Mom, I'm a freak and I'm weird and these kids laughed at me and, you know, whatever. I'm feeling all the embarrassment any kid would feel. And my mom says, you know, Peter, how many kids in your school look like you? I says, none. That's the problem, Mom. I'm a freak. I'm a weirdo. And she says, no, you're not a freak. You're not a weirdo. You're unique. You're special. God made you that way. And don't be ashamed of yourself. That problem was created by your teacher, not by you. You're capable of a great many things. And there's a few things you can't do, but there's way more things that you can do. And you know, she gave me a positive perspective on it, which really helped me. And there was many stories like that over the years with my mom, where she really just refocused for me, you know, that I could do anything I set my mind to. And she was always big on never let anybody tell you what you can and cannot do.
So she's really big, been a big influence in your, absolutely, in how huge you perceive your albinism. Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, she was the single biggest, you know, I'll tell you one other quick story, because it's meaningful to people with albinism. When I was much younger, I was probably in kindergarten, grade one, I wanted to learn how to ride a bicycle. And we lived in an apartment building in again, kind of tough neighborhood. So we didn't have a yard. We didn't have our own house. And my older brothers had this old bike that they had been using. And I got the idea in my head that it was time for me to ride this bicycle. No one had ever taught me how to ride it. It didn't have training wheels on it. But I was pretty adventuresome. And I thought, okay, I'm going to ride this bike. Didn't have a clue what I was doing. And again, bright sunny day, laneway behind the apartment building we live in, I decide to get on this bike. And it's quite a rough piece of pavement. So there's cracks and potholes in the laneway. And so I get pedaling on this thing, and I get up going to a good speed, and I don't see where I'm going, and there's this big pothole. My front wheel goes into it, and the bike goes flipping over, yeah, and I go flying off the bike, landing on the concrete with my shorts on. So my knee is gashed open, big cut. I'm bleeding. I'm kind of crying and upset, but just from the pain, just wincing from the pain. And a bunch of my friends and buddies were watching me do this, and so they're all kind of snickering that I wiped out, as kids do. And I get up, and as I get up from this, I remember that my mom was two stories up in the apartment building putting out the laundry. So all the women would be on their balconies putting out their laundry in the summertime on these clotheslines. And you could yell across the hall, the laneway, to another set of apartment buildings across the lane. So I'm standing there, and all of a sudden I hear this voice of a woman on my left side, a neighbor lady. And I hear her yelling out, "Can't you see he's blind? He shouldn't be riding a bike." So she's yelling at my mother, who I can't really see, but I think she's up there putting out the laundry, to the best of my recollection. And so I'm quite embarrassed and shocked and beside myself. What do I do here? And I'm paused, and it's like one of those moments in my life where the world stands still and time stands still. And I'm perched, looking to my right, looking up to see if I'm going to hear the voice of my mother. And if so, what will she say? And all of a sudden, I hear my mom bellow out more firmly and more loudly than the neighbor lady, "Peter, don't listen to her. Get back on your bike." And so I got back on my bike, and I pedaled again, knee still bleeding, faster and harder than I had the first time. And I went further down the lane, probably twice the distance I went the first time. And again, I wiped out, fell off my bike. And I kept doing this. And I gained more and more success over time. But that moment really was pivotal in my life. It really changed how I viewed myself and how I viewed how I would succeed in life, because she could have said a great many things, some of which would have been very helpful. She could have, you know, told that woman off. She could have come down and comforted me. She could have brought a bandage down, which later she did. But in that moment in time, her comment was addressed to me, not to the woman. It taught me to ignore that woman. And not only, you know, "Peter, come upstairs and I'll put a bandage on it," which would have been a normal parental thing to say, but she said, "Get back on your bike." How many parents would say that?
Yeah, and it had far bigger impact than putting a bandage around your knee.
Exactly.
For your future.
So it taught me, even if I fall and cut myself, the world's not going to end.
Yeah.
You're going to have a great many falls, and it's going to hurt. But the big thing to do is get up when you fall and keep going, right? And that stuck with me the whole life, and to the point, actually, where I've told the story countless times in my work at the UN and Tanzania and around the world. And every time a person with albinism hears the story, they take it to heart, you know. So I'm thankful for my mother. I give a lot of credit to her. And my father was very supportive as well, but my mom was more involved in the, you know, the more outspoken one of the two. And so for me, I'm thankful for that. And I always tell, when I talk to parents that have children with albinism who are, you know, anxious, you know, what do I do with this child? How's it going to work out? I always tell them some of these stories and say, look, your kid's going to have some challenges because of low vision, because of, you know, name calling. There's no question. Let's not pretend that's not going to be there. But how your attitude about it as a parent is 90% of the battle, because the child picks it up from you. You know, don't overprotect your child.
And with that attitude, did you have any ideas of what you wanted to be when you finished school? What did you go to university? What did you? What
well,
did you?
I had many great many ideas, as little kids do, about what they would be, and it had a big range of anything from, you name it. I wanted to be a teacher, a lawyer, you name it, a doctor. I remember one time I was fascinated with outer space, and I wanted to become an astronaut. This is as a grade six boy, and grade five or six, and I said to my mom, "I want to be an astronaut." I had memorized all the planets in the solar system, and I read about that in the encyclopedia. And she said, "Peter, you're not going to be an astronaut." I says, "Why?" She said, "Well, but to be an astronaut, you have to become a commercial airline pilot or a military pilot. And to become a military pilot, you won't have the vision required to get a pilot's license." So she said, "That's one job you just won't be able to do." And I remember actually being upset at the time because I had a childhood fantasy of being this, astronaut. And so, I put that one to the side. And got over it. I think it was probably okay with the next day. And moved on. And over the years, I played with a great many ideas. I'd taken a course or I'd taken an aptitude test for law that said I would do well in law, maybe. I wasn't really sure. But then I had, in my teenage years, a significant spiritual experience and became a Christian and decided to go into Christian ministry. And that was my first vocation.
Oh, okay.
So I went into theological studies. Took a four-year bachelor's degree in theology, studied, and then after that went into the ministry for a decade, was ordained, and then began my master's program during the process of my ministry, took a master's in counseling psychology from a seminary, and then my life shifted for a variety of reasons. I ended up moving on from ministry into business and into working with one of my brothers in a business he had started, my brother David, my middle brother. And then the three of us got involved in business together.
What business was it? What did you do?
In the finance industry, finance and real estate. Mm-hmm. A variety of different things over the years, and developed and grew different businesses together, and started some and so on as a group. And my brother David had started a business I joined, and then later on I got into real estate. So I've been in a variety of business endeavors for 15, 20 years now.
And so do you still do that, or do you full-time work for Under the Same Sun?
Well, I do a blend of both. Right. I've been very fortunate and very blessed that the businesses that I've been involved in have been very successful and very, very financially profitable. And I've been in a position where I can – I'm not operationally running any of the businesses. I sold one of my primary businesses, the finance business I was in, to some other people. And then I got mostly into commercial real estate. So now I own a variety of properties, strip malls, office buildings, so on. So I've been able to generate enough revenue from all of my investments that now I can basically be a very limited amount of involvement in my businesses and my investments, probably a third of my time. And the other two-thirds of my time is spent with Under the Same Sun. So I've been able to finance, a good portion of our startup and our activities were through the business income we've been able to generate.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. Peter will be back shortly. I've really, really enjoyed chatting with him. It's been fascinating hearing about his life and his work as a person with albinism. And I was particularly interested to hear about his family life and how his mum has been really instrumental in giving him the attitude that he has today, the kind of get up and go, you can do whatever you like kind of attitude. So the next part of the podcast, we're going to be chatting about the killings in Tanzania. So it's a real tough listen. And anybody that might find it, a bit difficult, because it is gruesome and it is sad, then maybe possibly don't listen anymore. Children, I think this isn't a listen for younger people as well. So we'll talk about that. This podcast is in two halves. Part two will be available for download in a couple of days. But the second half of this podcast is about to continue now. You can follow me on Twitter at Christina Venning. Find me on Facebook, The White Noise Show, or visit my blog, thebluffingtonpost.co.uk. But sit back and enjoy the rest of this podcast. So let's get on to Under the Same Sun. I've watched a few videos of you on YouTube and stuff talking about it. But for people that haven't, when did you first come across the problems that were occurring for people with albinism in Africa and Tanzania?
I heard about it first in 2008, and it was I was on at a point in my business where I had more time, mm-hmm. and I was really my wife and I were saying, okay, what we're praying about our future, what's next. And we're saying, you know, what do we do? And I was really thinking, I had more time now. I was less involved in day-to-day operations of the businesses. And I really wanted to get involved, maybe something overseas. I thought maybe something with people with disabilities, or I wasn't sure what. And I started looking on the internet on albinism somehow. And I came across this article on the BBC World Service website about a lady who was a BBC reporter who had gone undercover and done an expose on witch doctors in Tanzania selling albino body parts. And she had this was on the homepage of the BBC World Service on the day that I happened to be visiting that website. Some would call it chance, I don't. And I saw this article and I clicked on it, and it was a video clip of Vicky Antetema, who at the time was the BBC bureau chief in Tanzania. And she had heard about these killings in her country but wanted to go undercover. And she had a hidden camera, and she pretended, because she'd heard business people and wealthy people and politicians were going to witch doctors and wanting to become successful, and the witch doctors were prescribing the use of albino body parts. So she went undercover pretending to be a businesswoman who wanted to become wealthy to see if she could get a witch doctor to admit to her on hidden camera that this, in fact, was the case. And she did. She visited several witch doctors and got two of them to admit this. And she captured that video and sent it to the BBC, and they published the story. And that's really when the news broke to the world because of Vicky, that this was going on in Tanzania. And I then immediately thought to myself, I've got to go to Tanzania.
What can I just take you back to when you saw it? What as a person with albinism, what did you think when you saw that? Like, what were your reactions?
I was absolutely shocked. I mean, I had heard that people in African countries had problems with skin cancer.
Exactly. That's what I thought. I thought it was skin cancer. That was it.
I had heard previously, like I'd been to a NOAA conference years earlier, and there was a guy from Tanzania who talked about the skin cancer problem, and that's all I recall hearing. But this big thing about witchcraft and body parts was new to me. And so then I thought, okay, these are my brothers and sisters. They have the same DNA that I have. And I'm not African, I'm not Tanzanian, I don't speak Swahili. I don't know much about that part of the world. In my theological studies, I'd hear missionaries talk about their work in Africa, but beyond that, I knew nothing about Tanzania. And so I thought, you know what? If I were born in that country as opposed to Canada, I would not be able to go to bed peacefully at night knowing I'd wake up in the morning. And I thought, these are my brothers and sisters. Genetically, they're the same as me. And I thought of that quote that says that all that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. And I thought, I cannot sit here in Canada with the means to go get a plane ticket to Tanzania and the means to try and find out if there's some way I can help. I've got to do something. So it was literally impressed upon my mind so strongly that day. I felt this strong calling, literally.
So it literally happened in that day?
Literally, in that moment, as I read that article, I felt this thing that overtook me that said, Peter, you have to go. And because of my Christian faith, I understood that was God talking to me, and so I went. And I had no idea what I was going to face. I'd never been to Africa before. And I remember talking with my wife, who said, so Peter, you're going to Tanzania, right? I says, yeah. And she said, let me get this straight. They kill people with albinism there, right? And I says, yeah. And she says, and you have albinism, right? And I says, yeah. And she says, and you want to go there. Is that what you're telling me? I said, absolutely. She said, okay, just so we're clear. And she knew me well enough to know that once I got something in my head, it was going to be pretty hard to deter me. And she gave me her support with a little bit of anxiety mixed in. And she told me, if you go to the dangerous zones of the country where the killings are happening, don't tell me until you get home, so I don't worry about it too much. So I did. I went up to Mwanza, which is northwest Tanzania.
Who were you traveling with somebody?
There's a gentleman with me who had been working in my businesses, who had joined me in starting under the same sun. Right. I brought him on staff, Don Sawatsky, who's now my director of operations. And he's still with me to this day. And he and I went together. And I got off the plane, and I met at the time Vicky, who was still working for the BBC. I met Alshaima Kwegir, who was a member of parliament who had been appointed. She had albinism. And I met hundreds of PWAs from across the country. And people with albinism were living in a state of fear. I was overwhelmed at the sheer number of people with albinism. You see them everywhere in Tanzania.
Right.
It's unlike the Western world, unlike North America and Europe.
But you can go for like a year without ever, you know, all years without going somewhere.
Like, I was in Vancouver here for like 5 years before I saw anybody, other than my brother coming to visit. Beyond him, I never saw anybody. And you know, there you go down, you stand in the street long enough, just half an hour, you'll probably see one. One in every 1,400 people have albinism in Tanzania. So if you see 1,400 people, you'll find one, right? And so the sheer numbers of them was amazing. And then I went up to Northwest Tanzania where the killings were happening, and I interviewed families that had lost children to the killings.
How are you feeling yourself at this point, going to somewhere, like your wife said, where you, as a person with albinism, that could be killed? How are you feeling? Are you...
Well, I was feeling a little nervous. I had talked to a couple of people who told me that likely I would not have much of a problem because in Tanzania, they would not view me likely as having albinism. They would view me just as a white guy. Maybe they would think I was Swedish or Norwegian or something. So I had fair hair. Because in their minds, people with albinism have African features and white skin.
Right, because that's what they know.
Right, and so right. they don't get this concept that it's a universal genetic disorder, which is why the whole superstition and all the myths and the witchcraft exist, because they believe it's this sort of African curse, right? So likely from a safety point of view, they wouldn't occur to them that I had albinism. But nonetheless, my bigger concern, especially as I kept going back to Tanzania and I became very vocal about the killings, it became clear to me after a couple of trips there that my big threat was not the guy looking for albino body parts, but it was the authorities and the wealthy consumers and the government, some people in the government who might not like what I had to say. Because I was very vocal and the international media started catching and interviewing me. And it was clear that I was condemning the government for the lack of response in prosecuting the offenders, the perpetrators of these crimes. And so it was very sensitive to the reputation of the country internationally. And so I was becoming very vocal in the international media. And so my wife insisted, and I agreed with her, that going forward I have a security detail with me whenever I travel in the country for my own safety. And ever since then I have. And so that was my exposure early on.
And how was it, just from a practical point of view, of coming from, so I think Canada is warmer than the UK in the summertime, but I'm sure it's nothing compared to Tanzania. How was it as a person with albinism going to a country like that?
Yeah, Canada's not a lot warmer than the UK, a little bit, but not much. It's you know, we get snow in the winter and stuff. Vancouver's decent, but I would say obviously the heat was intense. I mean, I'd been to the Caribbean before on a holiday. And it was very much like that. Like, you know, it's like the temperature sort of varies between, you know, 29 and 38, you know. Typical temperatures are like 32, 33 degrees Celsius, right? And very humid, depending on what part of the country you're in. So the sun is unrelenting. I mean, I could totally get why you'd get skin cancer. Because it's every day. Like, it's not just a season of the year. And so unless you're wearing a hat and you're wearing sunscreen and you're wearing long sleeve shirts and you're being careful about sun exposure, you're going to get sunburned and you're going to get skin cancer. It's manageable, but you got to be vigilant, right?
Have you got burnt going out there?
Oh yeah, I've gotten some burns, but I mean, I'm pretty careful. Mm. You know, when I've got them, they were my own fault because I wasn't careful enough. Like if I'm dressed properly, and the closer you get to the equator, the more intense the UVA and UVB rays become. So yeah, I've had a couple of bad burns, but I'm so cautious. A, because I don't want to burn, but B, because I look like a hypocrite, because I'm going around the country preaching that they need to take care of their skin. Literally in public gatherings, right? Telling them to wear long sleeves and hats. If I'm not doing it, I look like kind of hypocritical. So I'm trying to be this model person with albinism in terms of how I take care of myself.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so because I've never been there. I'm just going on video and images that I see. So kids, obviously, kids with albinism are born beautiful, with beautiful skin. How old are they before they, under that sun, before they start to show signs of skin damage?
Well, you know, if it all depends on the parents. If they're typical, most people with albinism, they can start showing signs of sunburn at like a month old or a year old. And it can be really, really severe by the time they're 4, 5, 6 years old. You know, we've been to, and it all depends on the educational level of parents. If the parents have had a chance to learn about albinism and have been told what to do, the kids can look fine. But a lot of the parents, especially in the rural areas who don't have access to internet or even a lot of media, don't know what to do. And then these myths prevail. Like one of the myths in Tanzania and many African countries is that, we've heard it actually, we've gone to government schools for the blind where the kids with albinism have been put, residential schools, and you'll see them outside and their skin is horrible. Like they have really bad sun damage. Some of them early stage skin cancer, like elementary age kids. And you'll see that you'll talk to some of the staff who take care of the kids, and because the skin looks very unattractive, right? It's burnt, it's got sores, and they'll say, well, that's just how they are. So the idea is that you look at a person with albinism and their skin looks awful, that's just how they are. They actually believe it's part and parcel with the condition. So because most people with albinism don't know how to take care of their skin or don't do it, most PWAs don't look at their skin looks poor. Like it looks affected and unattractive, right? So that becomes a societal expectation. So in their mind, that is to be a person with albinism, to have bad skin. So we, our staff, for example, half of our staff in Tanzania, we have 18 staff, about half of them have albinism in our office there. They have perfect skin. I mean, absolutely perfect, right? But they're wearing hats and long sleeve shirts and sunscreen, and they're doing all the right things. So we do seminars and we show them, look, you know, so-and-so has albinism. He's lived here his whole life. Look at his skin. It's perfect. And then their eyes open and it's like, you mean I can have albinism and have perfect skin living in Tanzania? Absolutely you can if you do the right things. It's absolutely preventable, skin cancer, right? No one ever needs to die from it. But it's the leading cause of death. Like over 80% will die by the age of 30.
So that's their life expectancy somewhere.
Yeah, but 30. Because of skin cancer. And it's not the skin cancer that kills them. It's some other secondary cancer that develops from the skin cancer. And a lot of it's not treated early. Even when they get it, they don't get early treatment. And sometimes they'll even go to the witch doctors to get treatment for their skin cancer because they live in rural areas where there isn't clinics readily available. And so that compounds the problem. I visited guys in the cancer ward in hospitals in Dar es Salaam where they actually had been going to the witch doctor for like a year to deal with their skin before they went to the cancer clinic. By the time they get to the cancer clinic, it would often be too late. So we've seen many, many heartbreaking cases of skin cancer. It's the number one killer.
And how does that affect you? Do you get affected when you... Because to me, I look at pictures of these kids. I cry. I find it really, really sad.
I can tell you that the work we do is not for the faint of heart. Christina, unless you've got some fortitude, there's the skin cancer imagery, which is heartbreaking enough. I've seen some pretty bad cases where it's hard to look at. But beyond that, I mean, the very first time I went back to Tanzania, going back to 2009, and I went up to Mwanza, northwest Tanzania, where the killings were happening. And I went into when I landed, I got off the plane, I went to two homes where attacks had happened just weeks earlier. And the first home I went to, there was a mom who I interviewed outside of her home. These are very humble little shacks, really, in the rural areas. Most of them don't have electricity or running water. And they're sitting outside talking to this lady. Her little daughter named Mariamu, who I think was like 5 or 6 at the time, had been murdered just a few weeks earlier inside that house. And I interviewed her, the mom, who told me in graphic detail how the murder occurred. And they came in, men broke into the home. This is the pattern. They break into the home after midnight, bring down the door, they bring machetes, they chop the girl up, and they took her body parts. She bled out, took her legs, took her arms, slit her throat. And I'll spare you the rest of the details, but I saw where it happened. I went into Mariamu's bedroom, and there was still a blood stain underneath her bed where it had happened. And her story was horrific. And the mom told me, the mom was quite detached, wasn't emotional. She was still, I think, in shock to some degree. And I left there. That was my first exposure to this. And went to another home, heard a similar story. She told me that Mariamu had a brother with albinism named Inyasi, who was home at the time, but the killers weren't aware that he was there or had albinism, or they probably would have gone after him. He was a few years older. And as it turned out, he hid under his bed when he saw this happening. That's why they didn't see him and he was safe.
So he saw his sister.
He saw his sister after he saw her torso after. He didn't see the actual murder. He heard it happening because he was under his bed, but he saw her torso after he came out. He saw her remains. Right, she was dead, and he was traumatized. And there was also siblings in the family without albinism that saw this. The oldest daughter, Mindy, did see it. Actually, all happened. She didn't have albinism. Anyway, later that day, I went to a school called Matindo School, which is a government school for the blind. And the government had taken 100 or so kids with albinism and dumped them, rounded them up and dumped them in the school for their safety. The school was originally built for 30 blind children. And I'm visiting there and seeing the horrific overcrowding, 3 kids to a bed, and the fear in these kids' eyes was just, you couldn't get them to laugh or smile or sing or anything. And they were, because of all this stuff that was going on, they'd been hearing all these stories. And during the course of my time there, this boy came to me and kept wanting to hang out with me. And I picked him up. He seemed to be following me around more than the rest of the kids. And his hair was a little bit whiter. He might have had OCA1, I'm not sure, but his hair was a lighter shade because most of them have more of a blondish hair because they have OCA2. So they have a little bit of pigmentation. But this boy seemed a little fairer. Anyway, he was following me around, seemed really interested. So I picked him up and hugged him. And I was told his name was Minyasi. And he was very rigid when I picked him up because I could tell he was, you know, who's this guy? He wanted to see me, but he was sort of afraid of me all at the same time. And so he and I sort of connected and then bonded a little bit. And a little bit time later, I got into the Jeep to leave. And the driver got in, and I was just about to leave. And all the kids surrounded the car because they're all fascinated with the car. And then Yassi pushed his way through and jumped onto my lap in the car. And he didn't want me to go. He wanted to go with me. And I wanted to take him home so badly and, you know, put him bring him back to Canada with me. And he didn't want to go. I had to finally – he was kind of hanging on to me. And then I found out that that was Mary Amu's brother. And he didn't know that I had just been to his home and seen where his sister was murdered. And I didn't know that that was him. Somebody in the group, I think Vicky, told me this is Mary Amu's brother. So I could see. And then later I got to know the sister, Mindy, who didn't have albinism. Both of those kids now are in the End of the Same Sun education program. So they've been in our private education program ever since. So what that means is that we take kids that were in overcrowded government schools or kids who weren't going to school, and we put them in high-quality private English medium schools where these are not schools for the disabled. These are normal schools for regular kids that don't have any disability challenges, but they get a high quality of education. They get we train all the teachers on albinism. We do a seminar with the teachers on low vision, on discrimination, and we handpick these schools to make sure they're secure. They have fences. They have guards at night. And these are schools we select and we vet carefully. And
so are they kids that would wealthy kids be going to these schools?
Yeah, I would say maybe not wealthy, but probably middle class. Yeah, like working class Tanzanians who have certainly more money than poor people. Like the really poor folks only send their kids to the public schools, which are not really good. And then if your kid has a disability, they go to these schools for the blind or physically handicapped where they learn virtually nothing because they were trying to teach these kids Braille, right? And most of these kids had no need to learn Braille. And they weren't even learning Braille properly. And anyway, so we put these kids in these, and they're the only kids with disabilities in these schools usually. And so these are high-quality schools academically compared to normal Tanzanian public schools. So we put all of our kids in these schools, and Minyasi and Mindy were two of them. And Minyasi has progressed to the point where he's academically one of the best students in his class. And you got to remember, our kids are competing against fully sighted kids. And some of them are top performers in the top 10 of their classes. We give them binoculars, we give them low vision assessments, we give them, you know, whatever's needed. And we constantly train and retrain the teachers to deal with them. And also to deal with the trauma these kids come. Because beyond the low vision, there's trauma. Like, I mean, you got a kid like Minyasi and Mindy who saw their sibling murdered, right? So the post-traumatic stress they're dealing with can affect you academically, can affect your ability to concentrate and all of that. So these are you know, so in addition to seeing the skin cancer, we have to see, you know, the photographs and the reality of these mutilated bodies all the time of kids and adults with albinism who are murdered because of these witchcraft-related killings across Africa.
So can I ask you when did this first start? Like, when has this been something that's been going on for years and years and years, or is it a recent thing? Is it because of the media that has just picked up on it and reported on it, or when did it start?
Well, all the stigma and discrimination against people with albinism in sub-Saharan Africa has been going on, we believe, for centuries. In various forms. For example, in Cameroon, in one part of the country, they would feed people with albinism to active volcanoes because they believed it would pacify the god of the volcano. In a number of African countries, we would know that people with albinism would be buried with ancestral chiefs when they would die. They would bury someone alive with albinism with the chief to give him eternal life. We know also in Guinea, that in West Africa, that one of the previous presidents would feed people with albinism to his crocodiles. So this mystification that people with albinism are ghosts or you know, spirit beings or have magical powers inherently has been around sub-Saharan Africa for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So the killing and the abuse and misuse of people with albinism has been going on for a long, long time. This particular practice of commodifying and selling for a specific market price to consumers, the body parts, we believe is newer. And so the killing and stigma has been there forever in a variety of ways.
And what, so what, take me through it. What do they, what do these, how does the process work, and what do these people want? So you get the person that hunts a person with albinism, then they kill them. Then how does the whole, how does the whole process work, and what is it they want from the person with albinism?
Well, what they want is that they, because for hundreds of years they believe the person with albinism is not human. So you have to get to the foundational belief, right? They're not human beings. They're ghosts. In Tanzania, 00 is the term, which means an invisible ghost-like creature. Okay. So if you're Tanzanian with albinism and I see you, I'm seeing a ghost. I'm not seeing a woman. I'm seeing a ghost.
So people are frightened.
Well, they're frightened and they're also intrigued. It's almost like special power. Both frightened and in awe of. It's like you're a spirit being with all the powers that that attends, right? And you could bring good luck or bad luck depending on the scenario. But you, what is true about you is you're not quite the same as them. You're something other than fully human, right? And so because that belief has existed forever, upon that societal stigma of mystification of the person with albinism that everyone has bought into for centuries, comes the witch doctor who's looking to make a lot of money and who trades in the idea of spiritualism. And he says to a population of people who deeply believe in witchcraft already anyway, broadly speaking, like over 80 or 90% of Tanzanians believe in witchcraft, according to Pew Research. So people believe in witchcraft, including educated people, including people who go to church on Sunday, will still believe somewhere in witchcraft. And so you go and you want to become wealthy and powerful, and it's been a common practice for a long time to go to your local witch doctor. Very much like people here would go get their palm read, or they would go to a minister or a priest or whatever. People there will go to their local witch doctor, and they would get help, right? And the witch doctor might often prescribe herbs or, you know, herbal medicine if you got a headache. So he would give sort of herbal medicine, or mixed in with sacrifice a chicken, and give me a few bucks, and I'll listen to the voice of your ancestors, and I'll tell you what you should do, all the way to animal sacrifice, and all the way up to and including human sacrifice. Human sacrifice has always been part of witchcraft around the world. It's not new. And so if you want really powerful magic, muti, powerful medicine, you might need a more powerful sacrifice. And because people with albinism are considered ghosts, they're extremely powerful, you'll get really big bang for your buck, excuse the crude term, if you get an albino body part. So if you say, you know, let's say you're an MP and you want to get reelected, you say, hey, Mr. Witch Doctor, how do I guarantee reelection? And you already deeply believe in witchcraft. I'll say, bring me the arm or leg of a person with albinism, and I'll grind up the bones and blood into a potion with other ingredients, and you'll be able to sprinkle it in your home or wear it in an amulet or whatever, and you'll get reelected.
So they literally grind up the bones.
Yes, they do. And they'll also drain the blood and mix it with other liquids and other herbal remedies.
Have you ever seen any of it before?
No, because it's illegal, right, to use human bones in this way in Tanzania. And it's shrouded in a deep, deep, deep curtain of secrecy.
Right.
But we have court documents as well as testimony to the fact that that's what's done. I've not physically seen these. They would never show them to me, because if they ever showed them to me, I'd have them arrested. But
have you ever met a witch doctor?
Yeah, recently I did. For the longest time, I wanted to steer clear of them, and I still do for the most part. And the only reason I did was we had security with us at the time. And this particular witch doctor we met actually was implicated in the killing of Mariamu. They believe that there was legs of a girl with albinism brought to her residence the day of or the day after the killing. And she was questioned by the police at the time, and she was later released. Oh, no, what happened was she was questioned, and then she was arraigned in court. She was supposed to show up in court, and she vanished for a period of time. No one could find her. And then it got dropped off. I did talk to her briefly, and she didn't speak English, but I talked to her through one of our staff who spoke her language, Sukuma, the local language. And she, of course, denied using albino body parts, said it was wrong, she would never do it. They all do. It's illegal, right?
It's really funny. You say she. For some reason, I had this idea that they were all male. I don't know why.
No, it can be male or female. You know, I think a majority are probably male, but there is some female ones. And this woman looked evil. Like, I mean, the look of evil in her eyes was something I've never seen before. A little bit nervous, but I also felt like I was intrigued, and I was actually quite upset and angry. Like, I had to control myself. There's things I would have liked to have done to her, if I'm perfectly honest, as a human being. Knowing and having to, because we're the ones that are putting back together and sorting out the carnage left behind by people like her. And we have to look into the eyes of all the suffering and sort it out, right? So when anybody tells me that, witchcraft is benign, you should just let them have their way and do their thing, it's their religion, I look at this and say, well, I'm sorry. If that's it, then that part of the culture is just wrong. It needs to change, because I've seen too much damage, too much suffering for it to be benign for me. And so, yeah, we moved on, and she denied it. And but, you know, I would say that for us, what we have to do in our work is look at, in the midst of the carnage and the hope and the despair, there's a lot of hope and a lot of good news. You look at kids like Manyasi and how he's progressed and how he's smiling. He's one of the best students in his class. He's talked about several careers. One time he wanted to become the next president of Tanzania. Then he wanted to be a teacher, then a pastor. So who knows what he'll end up doing. But the kid's bright. He's exceptional. He's self-confident. He's healthy. He's safe. And so when I look at 320 students like that we have in our education program, all the way up from kindergarten to university level, and some of our university grads have already gotten jobs, good jobs, in the country. Like one of them is working in the prime minister's office as an economist. One of them is several are school teachers. Some are business people. You know, some are like in the trades, like carpentry, electrician type things. So when I see that, like the reason we do the education program is not because of educating people is good on its own, which it is, but we use it as a form of advocacy. We believe the way that society will change is that ultimately people with albinism will change the society.
Yeah, if people see people with albinism doing meaningful and, then they'll think, hey, these can't be ghosts. They have to be real
so
people.
If you go to school one day and your teacher has albinism, or you go to work one day and your boss has albinism, or you go to the government and the government worker has albinism, how are they going to be stupid, uneducated, ignorant, ugly-looking ghosts? You know, they're going to be human beings that are contributing maybe at the same or a higher level than you are. And so we believe that that will change the face of albinism in the society over time. And we will create, these advocates, right, that we release into the society. And that's only one of our programs. We also do advocacy campaigns, TV, radio, film, understanding albinism seminars throughout the country. We work at the UN. We work at the African Union. You know, but our goal is to really redefine all of these myths that people believe in.
And because Africa's obviously a poor country, the continent is a poor continent, body parts are going to be selling for a lot of money. So I'm guessing that the people that are buying them are people that are high up somewhere in maybe...
Absolutely. They're wealthy people. They're the elite. A complete set of albino body parts. In one of the court cases, the phrase was used, a complete set. So what happens is a consumer comes, sees the witch doctor. The witch doctor places an order to a killer for either an arm or a leg or a hand or a complete set. So the specific order is placed. Then the killer goes, identifies a person with albinism, gets the body parts, fulfills the order to the witch doctor, who then furnishes them back to the consumer in this potion. And a complete set sells for $75,000.
So what's that, all limbs?
So that's a complete set is like both arms, both legs, often the tongue, and it could include the genitalia in some cases. And an arm or leg might sell for around $4,000, a single arm or leg. And so depending on the order, but the real evil behind this, so far in the government, they've only put a few people in, they've only brought to conviction about 5% of all the cases so far in Tanzania that have occurred. 95% have still not been processed to the point of conviction.
And have any, so I take it some killers have been convicted.
Yes, and some witch doctors.
But never the people that have placed the orders for them.
Not only have they not been convicted, they haven't even been identified in open court.
And is that because it's people who are in government possibly? Or
we presume that, because one thing I tell you, like the witch doctors have actually gotten the death sentence.
Right.
It hasn't been implemented, but they're on death row. Like, right. Tanzania hasn't executed anybody for like 30 years, but it's still on the books. And these guys, even with the threat of the death sentence, they will not divulge the name of the consumer. So they're sitting in jail waiting to, you know, on death row for the rest
of
their
still
life.
Won't.
And they still won't roll over on the guy who bought the organs. That tells you something.
Wow. But why? Because ultimately they're going to die. So why won't they speak?
Well, they might have family on the outside still.
Oh, okay, of course. Yeah.
That they're afraid of. That these powerful consumers, that are rich, wealthy people, powerful people, could do them in. They, you know, who knows why, but we know that they haven't. And I think that this trade will not stop in Tanzania until the consumers are named and in the media publicly, and they are prosecuted. And that to do that would shake, could shake the government, and it could shake the society in a way that would be a huge issue. Because could you imagine if a senior government official was...
I'm going to say, unbelievable.
Let's say the very top government official, let's say somebody in the cabinet, you know, was involved, for example, pretend. I'm not saying that, but
yeah,
I have to be thoughtful about what I say here. But, you know, this is the kind of statements that I make that get me in trouble. But, you know, recently, a week ago, a Tanzanian newspaper called The Citizen, which is an English language newspaper, the link is on our Facebook page to the article, a Tanzanian government official stated that he believed politicians were involved in using body parts. And that's the first time in 8 years we've seen a Tanzanian government official say that.
Wow.
He said some politicians are involved. Because we see every year in Tanzania and in other African countries, the number of attacks and killings increase in the run-up to elections.
Right.
Like right now that's happening in Tanzania.
For the luck
to get re-elected. The federal elections are happening in October in Tanzania. And we predicted that there'd be an upsurge in attacks in the year prior to the elections, which there has been. It's true. It's been true in Burundi. It's been true in Guinea. It's been true in Uganda. It's been true in a number of countries, right, where we've seen this link between the number of attacks and political re-election.
Stop. So I told you some of that was a tough listen, and it really is. The second part of this podcast, part two, will be available to download in a couple of days' time. So please find us on iTunes for download or thewhitenoiseshow.com.